A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about Albert Einstein. Not just the greatest hits we all memorized in school, but the actual person. What he did for fun. What kind of husband and father he was. Basically, who was the man behind the equation, and what can we learn from the full messy picture?
The timing on this is genuinely interesting. We're in a moment where everyone's curating their genius. The productivity thread, the optimization culture, the performative brilliance. Einstein is basically the anti-influencer. He forgot his socks, he couldn't drive, he played violin to solve physics problems, and at one point handed his wife a written contract telling her when she was allowed to speak to him.
That contract detail is jarring. We'll get there. But that tension, between the public saint of science and the private disaster, that's the whole episode. And I think it matters, because if we only tell the cleaned-up version of genius, we miss what genius actually looks like, which is apparently a man in a wrinkled sweater who just capsized his sailboat again.
The capsizing is a recurring theme.
Let's do two parallel tracks. Track 1, the Einstein who bent light and stretched time. Track 2, the Einstein who couldn't find his jacket and told his wife to stop talking. And the two tracks are not separate, they're the same operating system.
And I want to start with the science, not because it's more important, but because understanding what he actually did makes the personal stuff land differently. When you realize this man rewired humanity's understanding of reality, and then went home and played Mozart badly on a violin he called Lena, the juxtaposition is the point.
He named his violin. Of course he did. So walk me through 1905. What actually happened that year?
1905 is called his Annus Mirabilis, his miracle year. He was 26 years old, working as a patent clerk in Bern, Switzerland. He'd failed his entrance exam to ETH Zurich on his first attempt in 1895. He wasn't some prodigy on a clear trajectory. He was a guy with a day job stamping patents, and in his spare time he published 4 papers that each, individually, would have been a career-defining achievement for any other physicist.
4 papers in 1 year while working a full-time job. That's the kind of output that makes hustle culture bros weep.
The first paper, and the one that actually won him the Nobel Prize in 1921, was on the photoelectric effect. The core insight, light isn't just a wave. It behaves as discrete packets of energy, which we now call photons. Shine light on metal, and it knocks electrons loose. But here's the weird part. Making the light brighter doesn't increase the energy of the ejected electrons. Only changing the color, the frequency, does that. Classical physics couldn't explain this. Einstein said, light comes in quanta, and the energy of each quantum depends on its frequency. This paper, by the way, is the one he himself called very revolutionary. He knew exactly what he'd done.
This is the paper the Nobel Committee cited.
And there's a reason. Relativity was still considered controversial in 1921. Too radical. Not enough experimental confirmation. The photoelectric effect was cleaner, more demonstrable. Also, the Nobel Committee had a weird bias against theoretical physics at the time. They wanted something practical. Einstein won for the photoelectric effect, but the prize announcement explicitly said they were not awarding it for relativity. Which is like giving someone an Oscar for their short film and saying, but not for that Citizen Kane thing.
The Nobel Committee as the original we-don't-get-it voters. So what about relativity itself? Because that's the name everyone knows. Give me the actual mechanism.
Let's start with special relativity, also a 1905 paper. The core insight is deceptively simple. The speed of light is constant for all observers, no matter how fast they're moving. That sounds innocent, but it breaks everything. If you're in a spaceship moving at half the speed of light and you turn on a flashlight, you'd expect the light to move at 1.5 times light speed relative to a stationary observer. It doesn't. It moves at exactly light speed, for both of you.
Which means something else has to give.
Time and space. They stretch and compress to keep light speed constant. Here's the classic thought experiment. Imagine you're standing on a train platform. Lightning strikes both ends of a moving train simultaneously from your perspective. But someone on the train, moving toward the front strike and away from the rear strike, sees the front flash first. This isn't an illusion. Simultaneity isn't absolute. What's at the same time for you isn't at the same time for someone moving relative to you.
Now isn't a universal thing. There's no cosmic clock ticking now, everywhere at once.
And this isn't philosophy, it's measurable. We've confirmed it with atomic clocks on airplanes. Fly a clock around the world and it comes back showing less elapsed time than one that stayed on the ground. The effect is tiny at airplane speeds, but it's real. And this brings us to the GPS example, which I think is the cleanest proof that relativity isn't abstract.
Yeah, walk me through GPS. I love this one.
GPS satellites orbit at about 14,000 kilometers per hour, roughly 20,000 kilometers up. Two relativistic effects hit them. First, special relativity. Because they're moving fast relative to us on the ground, their clocks tick slower, about 7 microseconds per day slower. Second, general relativity, because they're farther from Earth's gravity well, their clocks tick faster, about 45 microseconds per day faster. Net effect, satellite clocks gain about 38 microseconds per day relative to ground clocks, 38 millionths of a second.
Which sounds like nothing.
Which sounds like nothing, but GPS works by timing how long signals take to travel from satellites to your phone. Light travels about 30 centimeters per nanosecond. A 38 microsecond error means your position drifts by about 11 kilometers per day. Without relativistic corrections, GPS would be useless within hours. The engineers who designed GPS had to build Einstein's equations directly into the satellite software.
Every time you open a Maps app and it actually knows which street you're on, you're relying on a patent clerk from 1905 who spent his lunch breaks thinking about trains and lightning.
That's just special relativity. General relativity, published in 1915, is even more mind-bending. Einstein's big leap, gravity isn't a force pulling things together. It's what happens when mass curves space-time itself. The classic analogy, put a bowling ball on a trampoline. Roll a marble nearby and it curves toward the bowling ball, not because it's being pulled, but because the surface it's rolling on is curved.
This is testable.
It was tested spectacularly in 1919. Arthur Eddington led two expeditions, one to Brazil, one to the island of Principe off West Africa, to photograph stars near the sun during a total solar eclipse. The idea, if the sun's mass curves space-time, starlight passing near the sun should bend, making stars appear in slightly different positions than normal. They measured the shift. It matched Einstein's prediction exactly. The New York Times ran the headline, "Lights All Askew in the Heavens." Einstein woke up famous and never stopped being famous.
Overnight celebrity for a theoretical physicist. That's like a mathematician going viral.
This is where the two tracks really start colliding. Because by 1920, Einstein is the most famous scientist in the world. He's getting mobbed on the street. He's touring America and being treated like a rock star. And at the exact same time, his personal life is falling apart in ways that are hard to read about.
Let's cross over. That's the textbook Einstein, the man who rewrote physics. Now give me the man who wrote a contract for his wife.
Let's start with who he was day to day, according to people who knew him. Colleagues consistently described him as childlike, not in the naive sense, but in the sense of someone who never lost the ability to be completely absorbed in wonder. He had what one biographer called a ruthless intellectual honesty. He would follow an idea wherever it led, even if it meant discarding years of his own work. He called the cosmological constant, a term he added to his equations to make the universe static, his biggest blunder when Hubble discovered the universe was actually expanding.
Which is funny now, because the cosmological constant came back as dark energy, and he might have been accidentally right.
But my point is, he was willing to be wrong, publicly and dramatically. Most people at his level of fame protect their reputation at all costs. He wore the same clothes every day. He had multiple copies of the same gray suit so he wouldn't have to think about what to wear. He never wore socks. He claimed it was because socks always got holes, but his friend Leopold Infeld said it was really because he just didn't care. He showed up to a formal dinner at the White House in a sweater because he couldn't find his jacket.
There's something almost performatively anti-performative about that. The man who could visualize the curvature of space-time couldn't locate a jacket.
He never learned to drive. He lived in Princeton, New Jersey from 1933 until his death in 1955, and he either walked everywhere or had someone drive him. He said driving was too complicated. This is the man who derived the field equations of general relativity.
It's not that driving was complicated. It's that his brain had no bandwidth for things that didn't interest it. Which is charming and a genius, and probably infuriating in a husband.
Let's talk about the marriages. His first wife was Mileva Marić. She was the only woman in her class at ETH Zurich, a brilliant physicist in her own right. They met as students, fell in love, had a daughter before they were married, a daughter named Lieserl, whose fate is still unknown. Some historians think she died of scarlet fever as a toddler, others think she was given up for adoption. We don't know. Einstein never met her.
That's a haunting detail. A man whose face is everywhere, and we still don't know what happened to his first child.
They married in 1903 and had two sons, Hans Albert and Eduard. And then the marriage disintegrated. By 1914, they were separated. And this is the part that's hard to read. Einstein presented Mileva with a written list of conditions for continuing the marriage. It included, "You will stop talking to me if I request it. You will renounce all personal relations with me. You will not expect any intimacy from me." He literally handed his wife a contract for how she was allowed to behave.
The man who gave us relativity also gave his wife terms and conditions. It's almost impossible to hold both facts in your head at the same time.
That's the challenge of this episode, honestly. You can't separate the science from the scientist, and the scientist was capable of genuine cruelty. He was neglectful to his sons. Hans Albert later wrote about feeling abandoned. Eduard was diagnosed with schizophrenia and spent most of his adult life in psychiatric care. Einstein visited him infrequently and wrote letters that were more about physics than about being a father.
Then there's the second marriage.
Elsa Einstein, his first cousin. They married in 1919. She was more nursemaid than intellectual partner. Einstein himself said she was a woman who does not understand a word of physics. She managed his schedule, protected him from the press, made sure he ate. It wasn't a marriage of minds. But it was stable, in its way, and it lasted until her death in 1936.
You have this pattern. Brilliant theoretical physicist, deeply difficult human being, warm and approachable in public, cold and contractual in private. What do the people who actually spent time with him say?
The contradictions are what everyone notices. His secretary Helen Dukas said he could be incredibly gentle and patient with strangers who wrote him letters, but dismissive with people close to him. His friend and collaborator, Leopold Infeld, wrote that Einstein had a certain aloofness, but also an almost feminine kindness, when he sensed someone was struggling. He would spend hours answering letters from schoolchildren who asked him about science. But his own children got postcards.
The public got warmth, the private circle got distance. That's a specific kind of personality. Someone who finds intimacy harder than fame.
Then there's the play. This is where I think the most useful insights are. Because Einstein's hobbies weren't hobbies in the modern sense, they weren't things he did to optimize his productivity or build his brand. They were genuine escapes that, paradoxically, made his work better. He started playing at age 6, hated it at first, then fell in love with Mozart as a teenager and never stopped. He played every day. He said Mozart's music was so pure and beautiful that I see it as a reflection of the inner beauty of the universe. He owned a 1709 Cremonese violin he called Lena. During his 1921 U.S. tour, he played a benefit concert for Zionist causes and raised $10,000, about $170,000 in today's money. He also played in string quartets with other physicists, including Max Planck.
Max Planck, the father of quantum mechanics, playing chamber music with Einstein. The Nerd Jam session to end all Nerd Jam sessions.
Einstein was not a great violinist. He was competent, enthusiastic, but technically limited. He struggled with counting and would come in at the wrong time. His chamber music partners had to adjust to him, but he didn't care. The point wasn't performance, it was the state of mind. He said that when he was stuck on a physics problem, he would play violin and the solution would often come to him.
Which is the exact opposite of how we're taught to solve problems. Put your head down. Einstein's method was, I'm stuck. Let me go play some Mozart badly for an hour and see what my brain does when I'm not looking.
Sailing was the same thing. He loved sailing, but was terrible at it. He never learned to swim. He capsized repeatedly and had to be rescued. He once got stuck on a sandbar and had to be towed out. He went out in no wind and just drifted. He said, "Sailing gives me the feeling of being completely free." He didn't sail to get somewhere. He sailed to be nowhere in particular, with no goal, no destination, no purpose except the water and the sky.
The man who calculated the curvature of space-time just, that's not a coincidence. That's the same brain using a different mode.
He also loved detective novels, especially Arthur Conan Doyle. He would read Sherlock Holmes stories aloud to Elsa. He liked puzzles with clear solutions, a tidy counterpoint to the open-ended mysteries of theoretical physics. And he loved his pipe. He was rarely photographed without it. He said, "Pipe smoking contributes to a somewhat calm and objective judgment in all human affairs."
The pipe as cognitive tool. We should note, don't smoke pipes. But the pattern here is unmistakable. Violin, sailing, detective novels. These are all activities that engage the mind without demanding it. They're structured enough to hold attention, but open enough to let thoughts wander.
This connects directly to something modern neuroscience is now confirming. The default mode network, the brain state active when you're not focused on a task, is where a lot of creative insight happens. Einstein was essentially practicing default mode network activation before we had the term for it. He built his life around giving his brain space to make connections.
When someone says, "I do my best thinking in the shower," that's the Einstein method. The difference is he structured his entire day around it.
Let's talk about his politics, because this is where the contradictions get even sharper. Einstein was a committed pacifist from World War I onward. He was one of only four German intellectuals to sign a manifesto opposing the war in 1914. He said nationalism was an infantile disease, the measles of mankind. He advocated for a world government, for disarmament, for the idea that sovereignty should be subordinate to collective security. In August 1939, he signed the Einstein-Szilard letter to President Roosevelt, warning that Nazi Germany might be developing an atomic bomb and urging the United States to begin its own nuclear research. That letter led directly to the Manhattan Project.
The pacifist who helped launch the atomic bomb. That's not a footnote. That's the central tension of his moral life.
He knew it. He later called it the one great mistake of my life. He said he would never have signed the letter if he had known Germany wouldn't succeed in building a bomb. When Germany surrendered in 1945, he immediately wrote another letter to Roosevelt urging against using the bomb on Japan. That letter was found on Roosevelt's desk after he died, unread.
He tried to stop what he started, and the message never arrived. That's almost literary in its tragedy.
After the war, he became one of the most prominent voices against nuclear weapons. He signed the Russell-Einstein Manifesto in 1955, just days before his death, warning that nuclear war would put an end to the human race. The manifesto's final line, "Remember your humanity and forget the rest." That was his last public act.
Then there's Israel. He was a Zionist, but a complicated one. He supported a Jewish homeland, but also advocated for coexistence with Arabs. He was offered the presidency of Israel in 1952 after Chaim Weizmann died. He declined, saying, "I know a little about nature, but hardly anything about men."
That line is incredible because it's simultaneously humble and brutally self-aware. The man who understood the universe better than almost anyone alive admitted he didn't understand people, and he was right.
Knowing a little about nature, but hardly anything about men. That's basically his biography in one sentence.
Let me hit a few more details that I think round out the picture. His brain was stolen. After he died in Princeton Hospital on April 18, 1955, the pathologist on duty, a man named Thomas Harvey, removed Einstein's brain during the autopsy without permission from the family. He kept it in a jar for 40 years, occasionally sending slices to researchers, before finally returning what was left to Princeton Hospital in 1998.
The man couldn't escape being studied even in death. His brain literally became a specimen.
His last words were in German, spoken to a nurse who didn't understand the language. We have no idea what he said. The man who spent his life trying to understand the universe left us with one final mystery.
That's almost too perfect. The universe's last joke at Einstein's expense.
A few more practical details. He co-invented a refrigerator in 1926 with Leo Szilard, the same Szilard of the atomic letter. It was an absorption refrigerator with no moving parts, no electricity, using ammonia, water, and butane. They were motivated by reading about a family that died when the refrigerator's compressor seals failed and leaked toxic gas. The Einstein-Szilard refrigerator was designed to be completely safe. It never became commercially successful because Freon-based compressors took over the market.
Einstein the safety engineer. The man who unlocked the atom also tried to build a better fridge. I love that.
He also failed his first entrance exam to ETH Zurich in 1895. He was 16. He aced the math and physics sections but failed the general knowledge portion. Languages, botany, zoology. He had to spend a year at a Swiss secondary school to catch up.
The Einstein failed math. Myth is completely wrong.
He was ahead in math. He taught himself calculus at age 12. The myth comes from a misinterpretation of his school's grading system. They reversed the scale at some point, so what looked like a failing grade was actually the highest mark. But the myth persists because it's a better story. It's more satisfying to believe the genius was once a failure.
It lets everyone think they might secretly be Einstein. When the reality is, Einstein was always Einstein. He just didn't fit into the system.
Which brings us to what I think we can actually take away from all of this. Because you can't replicate Einstein, you can't copy his quirks and expect to get relativity, but there are patterns here that are useful.
Let's do takeaways. What do we do with all of this?
First, genius is not a personality type. Einstein was messy, contradictory, often wrong, sometimes cruel, frequently neglectful. He was not a role model for how to live. But he was a model for how to think, specifically, how to stay playful. His willingness to be wrong, to discard his own ideas, to follow curiosity wherever it led, that's replicable. You don't need his IQ to adopt his intellectual humility.
His intellectual humility wasn't fake modesty. He believed he might be wrong, and when evidence proved him wrong, he said so publicly. That's rare at any level of achievement.
Second, deep work requires deep play. The violin, the sailing, the detective novels, these weren't distractions from his work. They were part of his work. He solved problems by stepping away from them. This is a direct challenge to hustle culture's insistence that more hours equals more output. Einstein's output in 1905 happened while he was working a day job and spending evenings with his Olympia Academy friends, his informal discussion group, talking about philosophy and physics over cheap food and bad wine.
The Olympia Academy, that's the collaborative piece most people miss. He wasn't a solitary genius in an attic. He was constantly talking to people, arguing, testing ideas. Mileva probably contributed to his early work. His patent office colleague, Michele Besso, was a sounding board. The lone genius myth is just that, a myth.
Third, create space for the mind to wander. Einstein's entire lifestyle, the simplicity, the routines, the refusal to waste mental energy on socks and driving, was designed to free up cognitive resources for what mattered to him. You don't need to wear the same gray suit every day, but the principle holds. Reduce decision fatigue on trivial things so you have more capacity for the things you care about.
Fourth, and I think this is the hardest one, be willing to be wrong about big things. Einstein spent the last 30 years of his life working on a unified field theory that never panned out. He resisted quantum mechanics, God does not play dice, and was increasingly isolated from the mainstream of physics. He died still searching for an answer that didn't exist. And that's not a failure. That's the cost of doing original work. You're going to be wrong sometimes, maybe for decades, maybe at the end of your life. The willingness to be wrong at scale is what makes breakthroughs possible.
For a listener who wants to take one thing from this episode, what's your version of the violin? What's the thing you do purely for joy, with no goal, no optimization, no productivity angle? It could be an instrument, a sport, reading fiction, gardening, woodworking, anything that engages your mind without demanding a deliverable. That's not goofing off. That's creating the conditions for insight.
I think the deeper challenge is, can you be comfortable with your own contradictions? Einstein was a pacifist who enabled the atomic bomb, a humanitarian who was a terrible father, a man who loved humanity in the abstract but struggled with individual humans. He didn't resolve those contradictions. He lived them. And maybe that's the most honest thing about him.
Let me close with one open question. What would Einstein make of our world? of artificial intelligence, of quantum computing, which he would have hated and also been fascinated by, of a society that still struggles with the nationalism he called an infantile disease. The man who could visualize riding a beam of light at age 16 would be 147 years old now. I think he'd be horrified by some things and delighted by others. I think he'd still be playing violin.
We'd still have no idea what he was thinking half the time, which is probably how he'd want it.
His last words, lost in translation. His brain, pickled in a jar for 40 years. His first daughter, vanished from history. For a man who spent his life seeking unified understanding, he left behind an extraordinary amount of mystery. And maybe that's the point. You can understand the curvature of space-time and still be fundamentally unknowable to the people around you. Knowing a little about nature, hardly anything about men.
That's the line that stays with me, the self-awareness of it. He knew exactly who he was and who he wasn't.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1930s, Maya villagers in Belize fermented a beverage called balché from the bark of the Lachocarpus tree combined with honey and water, producing a mildly psychoactive drink that clocked in at approximately 4.8% alcohol, nearly identical to the 5% of a modern mass-market lager. Despite being brewed in hollowed-out logs without any instruments to measure specific gravity.
Belizean tree-barked beer, 1930s. Same ABV as a Budweiser. Good to know.
Hollowed-out log brewing. That's impressive process control for no instruments whatsoever.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps. We'll be back with another prompt soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.